He had a vague sense that he'd seen the dog before, though he couldn't remember when or where. Hey folks, how are you? This is Keith Tyler bringing you the Mystery Hour right here on Sunsounds of Arizona. Absolutely, positively wonderful to have you with me. Thank you so much for tuning in. Ellery Queen's Mystery Magazine and Mike Wheat bring us our first story, and it's called Old Dog. In the morning, there was an old dog in the yard. It looked like a mutt, mostly black, with a few uneven patches of brown. It could have been part Rottweiler, or German Shepherd, or a mix of both. The dog lay out on the front lawn, rolling in the grass and licking itself. Herman spotted it through the front window on his first trip down the hall, as he stumbled groggily to the bathroom. He ran a cool stream of water from the faucet, collecting it in the palms of his hands. Then he splashed it across his face and washed away the night's sweat. He caught a glimpse of himself through his dark brown fingers. Each day, the same wrinkled old man stared back at him in the mirror. But even after all these years, Herman wasn't used to his appearance. Every morning he startled himself, wondering who had come in the night, taken away the man he knew, and replaced him with his grandfather. Herman shook off the feeling as he headed down the hall to the kitchen, where he clicked on the radio to hear the day's news. He filled the kettle with water and set it to boil. The loud whir of the coffee grinder jolted him the rest of the way awake, followed soon by the whistle of the kettle. He had forgotten all about the dog until he walked back into the living room, carrying his steaming mug, and saw that it still lay out on the front lawn. Herman cracked the front door and looked up and down the block. A few neighbors were out and going about their morning business, but no one looked out of place or seemed to be searching for a pet. The dog must have realized it was being watched. It stopped its rolling and jutted its nose upwards, sniffing the air. "Shoo!" Herman called, hoping the dog would continue on its way and become someone else's problem. But the dog didn't budge. Instead, it flopped its head back toward Herman and spread its lips into a grin. "Git!" he tried next. The dog wagged its tail and rolled onto its side. When Herman didn't come pet it, the dog went back to licking itself. Himself, Herman realized. The dog now lay with its belly up and privates exposed, revealing his sex. He seemed friendly enough, but Herman still approached him with caution. You never really knew what you'd get with dogs around this neighborhood. As Herman neared the dog, he realized he was old. Wisps of gray were interspersed in his black and brown fur. He had a wide face and a broad, meaty chest. And there were scars and welts along his abdomen, maybe from fights when he was younger. Herman stood just out of the dog's reach and nervously held out his hand. The dog froze abruptly and looked at him. Slowly, suspiciously, the dog arched his neck toward him and sniffed several times, flaring his dark nostrils. Then he jabbed out his pink tongue and gave Herman several licks of approval. "Good boy," Herman told him. He noticed the dog was stark naked, no collar or ID tags. He glanced up and down the block again, looking for any clues. "Where's your owner?" he asked the dog softly, though he knew better than to hope for any kind of answer. Herman went back indoors to finish his coffee. At first the dog tried to follow him inside, but Herman shooed him away and quickly closed the screen door behind him. He watched through the front window as the dog settled back down in the yard, stretching and preening in the warm morning light. Once Herman drained the mug and began to move about, the morning fog started to recede from his brain. But something else was left in its place, tugging at the back of his mind. He had a vague sense that he had seen the dog before, though he couldn't remember when or where. Herman got dressed and started his day. He figured the dog would soon be gone, moved on to someone else's yard, or reunited with its owner. And Herman had plenty to do around the house. He had owned the house for more than 30 years and had lived in it alone for the decade since his wife had passed. It was an old ranch-style house, stucco and wood, with a roof of red Spanish tile. The small, tidy yard sloped down from the front of the house to the street. Next to the house stood a detached garage and the driveway where he parked his old Lincoln. In the back, he'd built a screened porch, where he and his wife had spent many evenings watching the sunset. Over the years, the neighborhood had changed around him, but he'd stayed largely the same. He still worked on the house each weekend, keeping it neat and trim, the way Estelle had liked. Today it was the back porch that needed repairs, where several steps were crumbling with dry rot. In the garage, he cut the boards he needed down to size and sanded their rough edges. The wood was thick and heavy, and he wasn't as strong as he once had been, so he carried the boards individually and stacked them in front of the rotting steps. With a hammer, he worked the rusted nails from the weathered beams and removed the old boards. He brushed the new boards with a dark, waterproof stain that matched the aged flooring as closely as possible, then leaned the boards up against the railing to dry. Once the dark stain had seeped into the wood, one by one he hammered the new boards into place. As he finished up his work, Herman heard a faint rustling behind him. Probably the wind in the trees, he thought, or one of the neighbors out in their yard. The noise seemed to stop, and he put it out of his mind, turning back to his task. But then, moments later, the rustling picked up again, closer this time. Before he could turn to look for the source of the sound, something cold and wet jabbed at the nape of his neck. Herman yelped and fell over, dropping the hammer with a loud clatter. The old dog had come around the house and stood looking at him expectantly. "Oh, you scared me," Herman huffed. "What are you still doing around here, anyway?" The old dog cocked his head, not understanding. His dark eyes glittered behind the gray fur on his snout. "Go on," Herman said, waving him away with his hand. But again, the dog didn't move. They spent a few moments staring each other down, then the dog walked to the base of the steps and lay down right where Herman had been working. It took several nudges and shoves to get the dog out of the way. Eventually, the dog got up and settled in the brittle grass a few feet behind him, so he could at least finish his work. When the steps were done, he took his tools back to the garage, then dug under his workbench through a dusty old box that had been there, well, as long as he could remember. At the very bottom, he found what he was looking for. In high school, his daughters had a poodle as a pet. They'd gone off to college, and later the poodle had died, but he and his wife kept the leash and collar as a keepsake. The old fabric was gray with dirt and grime, and the buckles were rusted. It was probably too short and thin for a dog of this size, but it was all Herman had, so it would have to do. The dog still lay in the backyard when Herman returned, panting in the warm sunlight. "Come on," Herman said. "Let's see if we can find your owner." The dog leapt up and wiggled excitedly as Herman buckled the collar around his strong neck. As soon as the buckle clicked into place, he bolted off, jerking Herman forward and nearly tearing the leash from his hand. "Well, hey," he called out, "wait." When that didn't seem to slow him, Herman decided to try heel, hoping that someone might have given him basic training, at least. The dog paused to glance ruefully at Herman, then reluctantly trotted back to him and stood by his side. Herman patted the dog gently on the head. Then they proceeded together on their walk. In front of the house, Herman turned away from the freeway and headed up the hill in the direction of the nearby lake. When Herman and his wife had moved to Echo Park years before, their neighbors were people who looked like them. They had raised their daughters over many happy years of softball games, summer cookouts in the park, and play dates with neighboring kids. Their lives were good until the earthquake of 94, which hit the old houses in the neighborhood particularly hard. Their neighbors, who weren't insured and couldn't afford the repairs, well, they'd sold their homes and moved away. Herman lagged as they climbed the hill, his old legs and lungs not what they used to be. The old dog slowly pulled ahead of Herman, and Herman let the dog's powerful legs drag him up the last stretch. As they crested the hill, they were treated to an expansive view of the city, from the towering buildings of downtown to the glittering ocean in the distance. The houses at this elevation were all proud old craftsmen, set far back and raised from the sidewalk. They shared the same view and were some of the most valuable in the area. Herman paused at the top and doubled over, wheezing the thick, smoggy air. The dog came over and sniffed at him to make sure he was all right.
Yeah, good boy,
Herman told him through strained breaths. He patted him lightly on the head. Then he glanced around in both directions, looking at the houses up and down the block. The solid old construction and sweeping views made the homes atop the hill some of the first to sell after the earthquake. Their new owners were of paler complexions and fixed up their old homes, adding their own touches. Wood-slatted fences around the yards, string lights hung across the gardens, expensive tree houses in the low branches for their kids. Herman could only think of one person he knew from the old days who still lived up here. He angled both himself and the dog and shuffled in that direction. Yesenia was out front in her yard when Herman and the old dog arrived. She had come out to take the afternoon sun, but had dozed off in her lawn chair. Herman watched the wide brim of her hat rise and fall slowly as she snored. He had to call her name several times, each time louder than the last, before she jolted awake. Yesenia winced at the bright sunlight and glanced about disoriented before she spotted him. But once she realized who had called her, a wide smile creased her face.
"Well, Herman Wells," she said, "it's been ages."
"I'm getting old. Can't be climbing up that hill all the time." Yesenia turned her attention to the dog, who sat patiently at Herman's side.
"And who do we have here?" she asked.
Oh, he's not mine," Herman told her quickly. "He was wandering around the block. Seemed to take a liking to my yard." Yesenia's eyelids fluttered as her gaze drifted back to Herman.
"Oh, Herman," she said with a grin. You're going around picking up strays?"
"Trying to find his owner, actually. Can't seem to get rid of him." Yesenia leaned back in her lounger, stretching the sleep from her limbs. She smoothed the wrinkles in her denim sundress and adjusted her hat on her head.
"You two want to come sit and take a break?" she asked. "I've got tea if you're thirsty. Water for him."
Herman sat in a chair at the table at Yesenia's patio, shaded from the sun by a big collapsible yellow umbrella. Through the old home's French doors, he watched Yesenia flit around the kitchen as she prepped drinks and snacks. She poured tea from a plastic bottle into a glass pitcher, painted brightly with flowers, then spread a circle of crackers onto a plate. She dug through a cabinet for an old beat-up bowl and filled it with water for the dog. She stacked the dishes onto each other and headed outside, stepping unsteadily in her foam platform sandals. Herman rose to hold the door open for her and helped her arrange the snacks on the table. She bent to set the bowl on the ground, which the dog trotted to and lapped at thirstily.
"How have you been, my friend?" she asked as they settled into their chairs.
"Well, I've still got my health and my house.
My daughter comes to see me sometimes. Can't complain. I remember your girls, Tony and Miriam, right? That's right, he said, beaming. Miriam's moved to the desert to find herself, but Tony, well, she still lives here on the west side. She comes to see me pretty often, usually at night after her shift. Yeah, my son comes to see me too when he can, Yesenia told him. But really, I can tell he comes to see the house. He wants to make sure I'm taking good care of his inheritance. They chuckled at each other over their glasses. The worst part is, well, he's not wrong to check. I raised him to be smart with money. How will our kids afford the lives we had with the world like it is? Well, today you have to be a millionaire just to get by, and Oscar does well for himself, but Lord knows he's not a millionaire. Herman nodded and sipped his tea. Yesenia drew herself up. She cast her gaze down, and her voice grew faint. Sometimes I dream about it, she said. I remember the old days and the way the neighborhood used to be. And then I dream I'm the last one left, and the new people line up outside my house with their agents and lawyers and interior designers waiting for me to die to see if they can take my house and all my things, if they can just get to them first. It was a feeling Herman knew well, though he didn't know how to tell her. So they sat for a moment in mournful silence until it was broken by a sound from beneath the table. The old dog had lapped up all of the water and then knocked the bowl over trying to get the last few drops. "You want some more?" Yesenia asked, scratching the dog behind its ears. The dog craned his neck toward her, enjoying the attention. She picked up the bowl and placed it safely on the table. The old dog watched her longingly until she began to pet him again. "You remember old Jeff, who used to live down by the lake?" she asked Herman. He hadn't thought of Jeff in years. "He used to have a dog looked a lot like this one." "Used to?" Herman said. Yesenia nodded her head. "What happened?" "I don't know," she said. "Used to see them both around whenever I had run down the hill. Last time I went by Jeff's house, the place looked, well, empty. And there were movers carrying his things. I asked where he'd gone, and they said he'd sold the house and moved out to Florida to be closer to his sister. Funny thing, in all those years he never mentioned a sister. Well, then again, he never said much to me at all." Herman nodded along as she told her story, his eyes fixed down on the weathered flagstone. When she was done, he drained the glass and placed it lightly on the table. "Well, I think we ought to get going," he said. "You sure?" she asked. "No more water for the dog?" "I'll get him some at home." "It was nice to see you, Herman," she said. She reached and placed her hand gently on his knee, then looked him straight in the eyes. "It's good to see someone from the old days. Come back up and see me again sometime." Herman felt the warmth of her palm through his pant leg. It was the first touch he'd received from anyone other than his daughter in months, and it made him, well, uncomfortable. He swung his leg away and eased himself up slowly from the chair. "Well, give me a bit," he said. "It'll take my old bones a while to recover from this climb." From Yesenia's, Herman and the old dog set off in the direction of the lake. The downhill was hard on Herman's joints. His knees creaked and popped with each step. The old dog had grown tired, too, and lagged behind. Even going downhill, his mouth hung open and he panted heavily, leaving puddles of drool every few feet along the sidewalk. This time, Herman paused to let him catch up. The dog plodded toward him and eyed him unhappily. "Oh, come on," Herman said. "I'm older than you are, and I've got two legs instead of four." Slowly they made their way down the hill, then around the flat blocks that led towards the lake. The houses around the lake were more like Herman's. Low ranchers, stucco and wood, with modest front gardens instead of stately porches. Jeff was a neighbor from the old days. They'd met him when he worked as a substitute in some of their daughter's classes. For as long as Herman had known him, Jeff had lived alone on a teacher's salary, and his little two-bed one-bath was all the space he needed. Now Herman wandered with the dog along the lakefront blocks, trying to remember exactly where Jeff had lived. Eventually he and the dog arrived at the house Herman thought had been Jeff's, but the building in front of him was completely different from what he remembered. It looked fresh and modern, painted a sleek shade of gray with white trim where Herman recalled faded pink and brown. A new bright blue door had been installed, and a white wooden fence ran around the small front yard. Near the sidewalk stood a sign announcing that the home was for sale. The sign was old and slightly beat up, printed with a weathered phone number. Even the realtor's name had faded. Herman made out the letters C, P, E, capital P, C, but the others had worn away. Below that sign hung another with a picture of the realtor. The man in the photo wore a suit and stood with his arms crossed, a broad smile on his face. His blonde hair was flecked with silver and slicked back tightly against his skull. Something about his face unsettled Herman. The man's gray eyes were dull and beady, and his pink lips were drawn back tightly over sharp little teeth. He reminded Herman of a predator photographed for a nature magazine, a hunter waiting for its moment to strike. A tug on the leash drew Herman's attention away from the sign and back to the dog, who had walked up to the fence and sniffed it curiously. The dog stuck his nose between two slats in the fence, then dragged Herman down a few paces to peer through another gap. Then he sat back on his haunches and whined. "What is it, boy?" Herman asked. Whatever the dog was looking for wasn't there. Herman lingered in front of the house for a few more minutes, taking in the scene before him and letting the dog chew nervously on the newly installed sod. Then, once there was nothing more to see, he and the dog turned away from the lake and started the walk back home. Even as they left, the dog still seemed to sulk. He dragged behind Herman all the way home, occasionally stopping in his tracks and turning back, sadly, in the direction of the house they'd just left. Both Herman and the dog were exhausted by the time they reached home. The sun had begun to dim and sink low, turning the clouds into glowing streaks of color across the sky. The dog lay on the grass in front of Herman's house, panting thirstily. Herman watched him, deciding what to do. "Well, no sign of your owners," he said, mostly to himself. "No missing dog sign flyers either." The old dog looked up at him, both hopeful and helpless. Herman sighed. "Well," he said, this time to the dog, "I guess you better come on inside." The dog dragged himself up and headed for the house, as if he'd understood. His tail wagged ferociously as he waited for Herman to unlock the door. Herman didn't have a dog bed, so he folded up an old towel in the corner of the living room and coaxed the dog onto it. As the dog happily settled down, Herman filled a bowl with water and another with some leftovers from the fridge. He set these down near the makeshift bed, but far enough away that the dog wasn't likely to knock them over. "Well, these are going to have to do for now," Herman told him. "We can get you your own things in the morning." Then he caught himself. Well, just until we find your owners. Still, you should have a real bed." The old dog was tired from the day of walking, and he ignored Herman. His eyes slowly drifted shut until he was fully asleep, snoring softly. Herman took care of a few more tasks around the house before he went to bed as well. Herman jerked awake in darkness, the orange glow of the street lights filtered through the curtains in his bedroom. He'd lost track of time and dozed off. He couldn't tell if he had just slept a couple of hours or almost clear through to morning. In the stillness of the night, his attention settled on the dog's raspy breathing in the next room. It had been several weeks since he first brought the old dog home. By now, he'd kind of grown used to that sound. As Herman slowly regained his senses, he heard something else as well. It was a rustling noise coming from the front of the house. Maybe the dog, he thought, his four legs jogging along to some pleasant dream. Herman rose heavily from his bed and puttered down the hall to check on him. But as he gazed across the dark living room, he saw that the dog lay perfectly still, aside from the slow rise and fall of his chest. Then Herman heard the rustling again and realized it came from outside. A shadow drifted slightly behind the plastic window blinds. Something was moving around in the bushes in front of the house. Groggily, Herman's feet found their way into his slippers, and he shuffled toward the front door. He inched the door open and peered out into the night. A column of cool, moist night air hit him in the face. Mist had blown in from the ocean and created a sodium-orange halo around each of the streetlights. From where he stood, Herman could hear the rustling more clearly, but he still couldn't see much, so he stepped out onto the front porch to get a clearer view. A dark shape fumbled around behind the bougainvilleas in front of his home. It tugged forcefully, seemingly stuck on one of the sharp branches until it finally broke free. When the shape emerged from the bushes, Herman saw that it was a man. He was tall and burly with large, veiny arms that stretched the sleeves of his shirt. He fussed with the fabric where a branch had ripped it and scratched the skin underneath. "How's it look?" someone asked. Herman tracked the voice and spotted another man standing further back on the sidewalk in front of the home. The man had sharp features that cast deep shadows across his face. Though it was hard to tell in the orange light, he seemed to have light hair, maybe blonde or gray. Before the bigger man could answer him, though, the light-haired man spotted Herman on the front step. His eyes flashed in the darkness, and a tight smile spread across his face. "Well, hi there," he called. "Can I help you?" Herman asked. He slurred his words slightly as his brain still emerged from the depths of sleep. The light-haired man jogged up the front walkway to stand a few feet from him. "Oh, I hope we didn't disturb you," the man said. "My associate and I were just walking by." He motioned to the man in the yard, who was picking twigs from his dark hair. "That's all right," Herman told him. "Are you the owner?" the man asked. "Yep, I've lived here for years." The man placed his hands on his hips and craned his neck back, looking the house over. With his face turned up to the light, Herman could see the features that had been hidden in the shadow. He had a sense he remembered that face from somewhere, though his tired mind couldn't quite place it. "Well, a nice place you've got here," the man said. Then his shoulders shrugged slightly. "Yeah, a little roof damage, a few small cracks in the foundation. Must be quite a bit of maintenance." Herman just nodded. The man scooted a bit closer and leaned toward him confidentially. "Thing is," he said, "my brother just bought a place in the neighborhood. I've been looking for somewhere I could buy to be near him and his family. Have you ever thought about selling, sir?" Though his brain still felt sluggish, Herman was surprised to find himself briefly toying with the idea. Maybe it was time to stop working on the old place himself, sell it, and retire somewhere cheaper. The way the man said it made it sound like a good idea. The light-haired man stepped up to the front porch and jutted his hand at Herman. "What was your name, sir?"
"Herman Wells," he said, taking the man's hand and shaking it.
"Cooper Price," the man said. He held on to Herman's hand firmly. His grip was surprisingly strong. Herman winced at the crush of bones in his hand. Well, maybe we can work something out just between us. I know my sister would be glad to have me nearby.
Sister? Herman asked. The man's face fell as he caught his mistake, but he recovered quickly. He smiled even more broadly, showing off sharp little teeth that glinted in the lamplight.
My sister-in-law, and my brother, of course.
He nodded to the big man behind him, who had squared up right at the base of the front step.
He tightened his grip on Herman's hand.
This is Arthur, my business partner. Together, I'm sure we can make you a very compelling offer.
Herman opened his mouth to speak, but the sounds that came out weren't words. They were a scrabbling noise, like something scraping across wood. Then the rapid click of nails.
It took all three men a moment to realize the sounds were coming from the darkened interior of the house. By the time Herman turned his head, he was already too late. He saw a quick flash of black in the corner of his eye. Then the old dog burst through the screen door, snarling and gnashing his teeth at the two men in the front yard.
Cooper leapt back and nearly toppled over Arthur.
"Whoa, whoa, easy, boy," he yelled.
The dog lunged at him twice, snapping and baring his fangs. "Come here, boy," Herman said, trying to wrestle the dog back inside.
I'm sorry, he's not actually my dog.
Herman grabbed the dog by his thin collar and tried to restrain him, but the dog was possessed by some vicious spirit. It took all of Herman's strength to keep him under control. Herman's heart pounded and his muscles strained. The exertion pulled him all the way back to the waking world, and suddenly Herman remembered where he'd seen that silver blonde hair, those thin lips, and sharp teeth before. He slackened his grip and let the dog's collar slip out of his hand.
Cooper flinched as the dog charged at them again. He managed to pull Arthur in front of him, and he cowered behind the larger man. The dog growled angrily at both of them.
"Hey, man," Cooper called, "come get this crazy dog."
Herman stared at the two men. "I've seen your face before," he told Cooper, "on the signs around the neighborhood. One of them in front of our friend Jeff's house."
The dog lunged and snapped again.
"Jeff moved out to live with some sister he never mentioned. Someone bought his house, fixed it up, and put it up for sale. Probably stands to make quite a bit of money, you know?"
Again the dog snarled and barked. The two men slowly inched away. Their eyes shifted fearfully from the dog to Herman and back.
It's just business," Cooper told him uneasily. "We help out folks who want to sell."
Herman's voice dropped low, becoming ragged and pained.
"I've lived in this house for 30 years," he said. "I raised my daughters, buried my wife. I plan to die in this house long after you're gone."
The dog leapt forward again, and this time his jaws closed on Arthur's pant leg. He tugged and growled violently, tearing the fabric as Arthur cried out and jerked backwards. Cooper kicked at the dog several times, jolting him in the ribs until the dog finally yelped and let go of Arthur's pants. Cooper shot Herman a look of disgust as he helped his injured partner to his feet, and the two men hobbled away. The dog chased after them. He ran to the edge of Herman's lawn, barking a deep, angry sound, dampened by the thick night air until the two men were out of sight. Once the men were gone, a change came over the dog. He stopped barking and sat down patiently in the grass. Herman approached cautiously and bent down beside him. The dog turned to him and licked docilely at his fingers.
"You can't be snapping at visitors," Herman told him. "It isn't good manners."
The dog's eyes went wide, and he shook his head. Then he stood and trotted back up to the front steps. He sat and stared expectantly at Herman. Herman pulled himself back up and swung open the damaged screen door. The dog raced ahead of him, bounding across the living room and collapsing onto the deep folds of his dog bed.
He curled and shifted until he got comfortable. Then he settled down and his eyelids began to droop. Herman closed the front door gently and reveled in the nighttime quiet. His heart was still pounding, his chest was hot, and the blood still pulsed in his ears. He collapsed in his armchair and glanced down at the dog beside him. "I guess you'll be staying here, at least for now," he told the old dog. "You can help me take care of the place." The dog's eyes narrowed slowly until they closed all the way. His breaths grew slower and lighter. Beside him, Herman sunk deeper into his chair. His vision grew dim and blurry. Herman tried, but he couldn't remember what Jeff had called the old dog. "Well, we'll have to come up with a name for you," he muttered in his mind. Herman ran through all the dog names he could think of until he was swallowed up by sleep. Kind of makes me wonder who was the old dog in that last story. Probably both of them. I like that one. All right, I have swung, sashayed, and slid on over to another issue of the Ellery Queen Mystery Magazine to their Passport to Crime section. The title is called The Wages of Sin, and it was written by Francois Blomhoff, translated from Afrikaan by Josh Pachter. As he strides through the long grass, he sees something glittering up ahead in the moonlight. His name is Andries Barkhuizen, and there's a reason he finds himself traveling this field in Cape Town's northern suburbs so late in the evening. He parked four blocks away to ensure that none of the residents on Krieg Street will remember having seen his car. Later, when the police investigate, no one will be able to describe it or recall its plate number. He moves closer to the object in the grass. Its reflection comes and goes as he approaches because the grass sways in the wind, concealing and revealing it. He looks around nervously, suddenly convinced this is some kind of trap. There have been several attacks out here in recent months, and it could be that the thing, whatever it is meant to distract him. It could be that he will be the assailant's next victim. No, that's stupid. No one could be sure he would notice it. A small item in the tall grass in a wide field? And why would anyone think there might be another late-night visitor to this lonely place given the attention the attacks have received in the press? There are only five houses in Krieg Street beyond the field, and he is here because one of them belongs to Julian Stein. In his mind's eye, Andries can still see Katrien sitting on the couch in his living room that afternoon, her face awash with tears. I'm sorry I came, she said. I didn't know where else to turn. I had to talk to someone. He wished she had said that she had to talk to him. But honestly, what difference would it have made? Their relationship was broken, no more subject to repair than a shattered china cup. Was it really only a year ago that Julia Stein had come into their lives? There had almost immediately been whispers about the charming new employee's love life, although Andries had dismissed them, at first, as mere jealousy. He was satisfied with his position and salary and happy in his relationship with Katrien. He had befriended Julian, they had hung out together frequently, and he hadn't felt threatened by the newcomer.
Julian wasn't a particularly enthusiastic worker, but customers couldn't wait to sign the contracts the personable new salesman offered them. He progressed through the company ranks with stunning speed, soon reached the same level as Andreas on the organizational chart, and soon after that moved further up the ladder, leaving Andreas behind. Then the bastard stole Catherine from him, and then, within 2 weeks, dumped her. The rumor mill had it that he had moved on to Debbie Van Breda, who worked in employee benefits and whose husband, Barry, ran human relations. Next month, Julian would be transferring to a corporate headquarters as a director. In his new role, he'll be surrounded by security, so Andreas realized that if he intends to carry out the crazy idea that's been brewing in his head, he had to act soon. He cased the area yesterday, and he knows that between where he stands and the house, there are plenty of stones. He can't wait to hear Julian's window shatter. That ought to teach the bugger a lesson. But now he reaches the object that twinkles on and off in the moonlight. And he sees it's some kind of a gun lying there in the grass. Andreas knows next to nothing about guns. Is it a pistol? A revolver? Well, whatever it is. What in the world is it doing out here in this desolate field? Oh, maybe it belongs to the person responsible for the recent attacks. Maybe he dropped it accidentally or threw it away on purpose. Andreas bends down and picks it up. It's heavier than he thought a gun would be. Its grip fits nicely into the curve of his palm. Feels somehow as if it belongs there. He clumsily figures out how to break open the cylinder, and the moonlight is bright enough to see that only one chamber is empty. 5 cartridges, bullets, rounds, whatever they're called, remain. How hard can it be to make the thing shoot? You just point it at whatever you want to kill and pull the trigger. Whatever you want to kill. For just a moment, Andreas considers dropping the revolver back where he found it, but only for a moment, because all at once he's excited. How can he have thought that a few broken windows would be enough? Now he has a way to fully repay Julian Stein for all the harm he has done. Do I have the guts for this? He asks himself. But he's already resumed moving through the tall grass toward the houses. Halfway there, he comes to a sudden halt. Julian stole his girlfriend and then abandoned her, breaking her heart. That means that he, Andreas, her previous lover, will be a suspect in his murder. And then a second realization hits him. Catherine will also be suspected. Scenarios whirl across his mind. Rumor has it that there are 4 other men at the company whose girlfriends or wives have succumbed to Julian's attention. And Andreas is confident there are more who haven't yet been gossiped about, but will be after Julian's death. In fact, the guy has made so many enemies within the organization that the police will have a heck of a time questioning them all. And of course, it's not his revolver. Nothing connects him to it. He can break in, shoot Julian, get rid of the darn thing somewhere, and he'll be in the clear. He resumes walking, reaches the far edge of the field. There are the stones he meant to fling through Julian's windows. And there are the windows. There is the house. No street lamps. Well, yes, 3 of them. All as dead as Julian the Conqueror will be in a few short minutes from now. The other 4 homes are dark, but the dim light burns in Julian's. Is he awake? Andreas hopes so. He'd like to see fear in Julian's eyes when he catches sight of the gun. Killing him in his sleep would be anticlimactic. It shouldn't be hard to get into the house. The last time he was there, an invited guest, he'd used the bathroom, and the wind howling at the window had annoyed him. He tried to close it, but there was something wrong with the catch. If Julian hadn't had it repaired, he can slip in that way.
He conceals himself for a moment behind a bush about 4 meters from the house. He'll have to make his getaway quickly, since there'll be a hue and cry once a shot has been fired. Or perhaps not. Once again, the wind is making quite a lot of noise. Even if someone does hear a bang, they may well think it's just a car backfiring. Andries peeks around the bush. There's a glow behind Julian's living room window, but it's coming from deeper in the house, probably the bedroom. Maybe Julian's not alone. Maybe he's seducing some new girl. Andries stifles a laugh. Apparently, Julian doesn't limit himself to girls. The rumor mill has also linked him to Alex Underwood, an executive in his late 50s who dresses like a boy of 20, with tightly gelled hair and round glasses in purple frame. For a while, Julian and Alex ate lunch together in the company cafeteria, and it was Alex who had recommended that Julian be promoted. Shortly after that sensational development, Alex was seen knocking on the door of Julian's new office at lunchtime, twice, but then proceeded to the cafeteria on his own. On the second occasion, Julian showed up with 2 girls from systems on his arms, and that same afternoon, Alex tried to hang himself with his tie from a beam in his office ceiling. A good thing the tie wasn't as strong as it was stylish. His secretary, who'd returned to retrieve a file she'd forgotten to take with her, cut him down in time. He still has a bruise on his neck that peeks over the collars of his striped shirts. Andries' heart races the way it does when you're about to do something you know will make a difference in the world. "This is for you, Katrine," he thinks, slipping around the corner of the house. "Though you'll never know who the gift came from." The bathroom window is half open. Andries considers that to be a sign, just as his discovery of the gun was a sign. Death is Julian Stein's destiny. He can already see the anguish that will be written across the enemy's face, already feel the rush of power as he pulls the trigger, the pounding of his heart as Julian is forever stilled. He'll have to wipe clean whatever he touches. It won't do to leave fingerprints behind. He pushes the window all the way open. It doesn't make a sound. Yes, that's wide enough. He begins to hoist himself up through the opening, and then he realizes that he can't go through with it. He curses himself because he knows that he is nothing but a pathetic loser who has allowed the woman he loves to be taken from him and used and broken. He realizes, too, how sick and weak and delusional he has been to pretend to himself that he's out to right the wrong that was done to poor Katrine. No, he sees at last that was just a rationalization. If he were to go ahead and murder Julian, he would be doing it for himself, not for her. He drops back to the ground and hurries away, chilled by the thought of what he has almost allowed himself to become. He starts to run, to put as much distance as possible between himself and the crime he has come so close to committing. And yet he wonders, when he is halfway across the field, is there enough distance in the world to return me to innocence? How innocent can I be when I was only seconds away from taking a human life? Yet another realization strikes him, and he's still holding the gun. He drops it, well, quite by chance, in almost the exact same place where he found it. 2 days later, Andries was arrested and charged with the murder of Julian Stein. When the local police began their investigation of the shooting, they got lucky right away. A vagrant took the detective straight to the gun he had stumbled across in the field behind the dead man's street. The homeless man had been careful not to touch it, and ballistics determined that the fingerprints found on the weapon matched prints on the outside of Stein's bathroom window, which they concluded was how the killer must have gained access to the house. The revolver had been fired once, and the remaining 5 bullets were identical to the one that had killed the victim. Fingerprints of Stein's co-workers were taken, of course, and the prints on the gun and window were identical to those of Andres David Barkhuizen, who was tried for and convicted of murder. Now, in his cell, Andres is sometimes bitterly upset, while at other times he finds relief in the knowledge that Katrine and others in their circle have been avenged, while still others will be spared similar humiliation. Julian deserved to die, but his death somehow disturbed the balance of the universe, and there must be order in the world. That's how Andres has decided to think about his incarceration, and he accepts his fate. A murder was committed, and the scales must be balanced. And the fact is that he wanted to kill Julian Stein. He had envisioned himself doing so. Perhaps in some metaphysical way, he was responsible for Julian's death. Still, he wishes he knew who it was who actually pulled the trigger, the person whose debt he has been condemned to pay. Alright, staying in that same Ellery Queen Mystery Magazine, I have time for a poem. Written by Tom Tolney, it's called To Sail or Not to Sail on a Frigid Morning. At first light, the blade of cold was so sharp it slit my throat without drawing blood. From the gunwale I could hear icicles sharpening on the dock, observe stretches of frost splintering the deck. Neath wildly flapping cloth, I stopped breathing in a blast of blow. Sail away in the cutting wind, or warm myself in my cabin on the shore. As the broken edges of sun crept up the sky, the morning's frozen fabric propped up my bones, so I hooked up the anchor aloft, untangled the moorings, and shoved out over trembling, impulsive waters. And then by Carl Robinette, The Lost Poem. Smell of blood still on the air, I hung my toe at the edge of the floor-to-ceiling window, flicked my brochured doubloon, and watched it disappear down the stories below. I had a funny feeling, like looking sidelong through a rear view. What's been done can't be undone. But it clung there anyway, an unwashable spot on my memory, an unanswerable question. Did she push him or just watch him fall? Where is she now? A sleepwalking shadow cast by searchlight dreams. Standing there, I watched Hollywood creep its pretty pace across the concrete coil, players and pushers, strutting and fretting, under the sign which stood for nothing and never would in a million tomorrows, in smog and bad sunshine, like some murky hell. I checked my watch and snapped off my photo, waiting at the edge of this high window.
Thank you. Never let it be said this ain't a classy show. Poems and everything.
Well, folks, I'm out of time. Keith Tyler here saying thanks again for joining me. Tune in again next time, would you please? Make sure your I love yous are in order. Thanks. So long.